Oh my goodness, we have to check in with great friend of the show, actor, author, and storyteller. And we didn't plan this because, you know, it's radio, but Stephen Tobolowsky and I with matching shirts today. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, hello, Rich. There was no planning done. None.
Well, how have you been?
Oh, it's been wild. I got another grandbaby.
Wow, congratulations.
So now I got two. And so there's been a lot of grandbaby duty. And on the home front, I got a sudden, like, rain of jobs all of a sudden.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, which is fantastic. But a lot of it is because they've all been delayed because of COVID. And now they're saying, like, okay, let's do this now. So now I'm going off to all these far-off ports to do some work, which is good.
I have to tell you, you made me do something I wasn't sure I'd do, and now I'm hooked. Because of you, I finally watched my first Hallmark movie because I loved Haul Out the Holly. You were great.
So should I? Okay, so here's the secret. The thing that's fell right in my lap now, Haul Out the Holly, turned out to be one of the most popular Hallmark Christmas movies ever. So this morning... they're saying they want to do Haul Out the Holly 2.
Of course they
do.
And
they just sent me a script. And so I got all these like contracts. Can you sign this? We're going to send you off to, you know, because we discussed where we shot this.
Yeah, back
on the
at Salt Lake City when it was hotter than blazes, right?
This will also be shot in Salt Lake City. We'll start in... Rich, in 3 weeks.
Oh, my.
I just got the script. In 3 weeks, we start at Haul Out the Holly Part 2, and it is a delightful script, very funny. And but it won't be as hot as it was before. But for the people who have not seen Haul Out the Holly, and you can see it, I have a tell now for when you can watch to know how hot it is. Now, you can't look at the actors, because we're all dressed in all the big coats and hats and suits and gloves and everything in the 111 degree temperature in Santa, Utah.
Oh, no.
But it's the extras. If you watch the extras, they will not wear gloves. They'll wear the coats. They'll wear the hats and the scarves, but they have to. But they won't wear gloves, and that's how you can know how hot it is.
Oh, well, I can't wait to see. I loved it. I mean, Lacey Chabert, she's the queen of Hallmark, but then you had Ellen Travolta. It was a terrific cast.
Oh, it was a great cast. We had a great time. And so it's no big surprise that Haul Out the Holly Part 2 will have all the same gang back and all the same characters back. And it's a year later. And that's all I'm going to tell you about all the complications that happened.
Well, but when you did it, we sit here on the air after you got off the air. We said, you know what's going to happen with this? They're going to love Stephen in this movie, and he's going to become a Hallmark regular.
Well, I tell you, you know, I do love working with Hallmark. You know, you work with a lot of different people out in the world, and the thing I love about Hallmark is they really know what they want. It's completely professional from beginning to end. You have great, you know, for me, I love the crew. The temperature, you know, when you take that temperature of that roast to see if it's done, it's the same thing with any kind of film or television. It's the crew that tells you if what it is and the technical people, the crew, the costumes, the sets, all that stuff. Those people are first class, and the producers are first class. Everybody's really nice. Everybody's super professional.
Also, I saw you worked with, I think, one of the funniest people in the business. What was it like working with Cherry O'Terry?
Oh, Cherry. first of all, we had a great time. Cherry and I had a great time. I have to explain, that movie, which I think they've changed the name a few times, was in the height of COVID. It was terrifying. It was in the part of COVID where everybody had to wear like surgical gowns. You know, we're wearing masks. So Cherry and I we are in this house and we each have our own room. We each have our own masks, but whenever anybody had to do any group scenes, all the crew, that it looked like we were shooting it on Mars, but it was terrifying. But we were all happy to do it because it was the first time we were stepping back into the world of this disease. Nobody knew at the time. If you go back, Rich, nobody knew at the time how bad COVID would be. Is it a fatal thing? Because it was just in China and all these people were dying. And now it was in America. And now we decided they closed down one day at a time, you know, because they couldn't have an audience first. Mm. And then Sony closes it down. And then I get this offer to do this movie with Cherry. And we are scared to death. But, you know, you can't keep an actor off the stage, as they say. So we did it, and we just had a great time. So as great as you can have.
Yeah, with all those preconditions. I saw you did an episode of George Lopez's new show, too.
Yes. Yeah. Now, that was, I had a great time with George. And I have to say, a lot of the people, not a lot, but several key people from One Day at a Time had moved to the George Lopez show, including Deb Wolf, who was one of our key writers at One Day at a Time. And now she's gone over to George Lopez as a key writer and a producer. So Deb had asked me if I would do this episode of George Lopez. And George and I know all the same people. And so we were back in the dressing room and we had the most fun. I think the one, he can handle an audience like nobody I could ever see. But we have a very short time in sitcoms to learn our lines. And so in this, we had 5-day rehearsal, and then you do it in front of a live audience. And so I had this huge, you know, emotional scene with George, where I'm talking about his son and my daughter and his daughter and my son, and what a disappointment my son is to me, and how amazing his daughter Mayan is, and how she's great. You know, you got to, and we're both drinking and we're both drunk in the scene. And I go, you know, just, you know, Dylan is such a huge disappointment to me. And George is going, well, he's not that bad of a kid. And we're going on. And then a voice comes out of nowhere saying, wait a minute, who's Dylan? And I look and it's like one of the ADs. And I go, what, excuse me? You just said Dylan was a disappointment to you? Now the live audience is there. And I said, yeah, yeah. And they go, who is Dylan? Dylan's not in this show. And I'm going like, oh, that's right. That's not my son's name. Oh, I don't know why I said Dylan. And George said like, so what? He goes, so why am I crying at this story? I had it wrong too. I said, George, the same thing will happen to you in this show, I promise you. So let's just do this again. Let's do this again and we'll get it right this time. And sure enough, in the next scene, George made a mistake. And I said, okay, George, now we do it. We'll do it again. We'll do it right. But that was so much fun. The George, he is so funny in front of a live audience. He's just genius. It was wonderful.
And now the Goldbergs has come to an end, but what a great run that was for you and everybody involved.
Very surprising. The run, not that it came to an end, but it ran for 10 years. Mm. And that's unheard of. Usually a sitcom is considered massively successful if it runs like 8 years. 5 years is considered like you're a hit, but 8 years is crazy. But they ran 10. And it was so popular on so many different stations on the dial. And, of course, working again with all those people, you put in the Meet Thermometer. That's another show where the technical people were so brilliant on that. Yeah.
We're talking with Stephen Tobolowsky on Downtown. I know you do a lot of voiceover work, and I know Carrie loved the initial original version of the show. You've done some episodes of the new Animaniacs.
Oh yes. Yes. That was, God, all of these shows now have the hint of sci-fi because of COVID. That was like in the heart of COVID as well, doing Animaniacs. And I was told to go to this studio called Igloo Studios, which is right next to Nickelodeon. And I went into Igloo Studios and the whole place is deserted. And then there is a loudspeaker saying, please sit down and fill out the form in front of me. I'm going, oh, okay. So there's this piece of paper there, fill out the form. And then they go, Stephen, we're ready for you on sound stage 3. Go down the hallway, turn to the left. No humans yet at all. And I go into sound stage 3. There's a microphone and there's 5 TV screens in front of me. And suddenly the writers and producers show up. I didn't see a real person on this job at all. And then when you left, you had to wash your hands and everything in case you got COVID on you. I mean, it was like a science fiction thing. But I love Animaniacs. It's a crazy. Also Pinky and the Brain. Is that part of Animaniacs?
Mm. Yes.
Yeah. It's gosh, so funny. So funny. So good. Yeah.
And I've told you this before. When my son was a little bit younger, we used to watch The Loud House all the time. And that's a terrific show.
Now, did we talk about, I just did 2 versions of the filmed version of Loud House.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, they flew me out to, a place where the COVID restrictions are very loose, out into Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Oh.
And there they have 11 little kids. I mean, and they're shooting it live. And they have a couple of, important people that do the animated version, the voice of the, and they're acting here. And it was hilarious. I did 2 shows for them there, and they threatened to have my character come back, which would be a lot of fun. Albuquerque is a very strange, have you been to Albuquerque?
Well, I think we were there. That was last fall, right? Because I think we were there at about the same time. I was out there in September broadcasting a football game.
I was there before I did the Haul Out the Holly.
Okay.
So for me, I was there late spring, early summer.
Oh, okay.
And in Albuquerque, I noticed they have no breakfast. They don't believe in breakfast in Albuquerque. When you have to go to work, you usually have to go to work at like 8 in the morning or something, and you usually have to have breakfast before that. But the restaurants in Albuquerque don't open till 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. So you are out of luck for breakfast, but they're really big in terms of the nighttime drinking on the roof.
Yes,
they have these
yes.
rooftop bars, and boy, those are special. You see the mountains, and you have your pina colada. Very nice.
It appeared to me, too, that you had to be at a certain income level to have any kind of lawn. That most of the houses I drove by, people had the crushed terracotta stones, but if you got into the right neighborhood, there's some grass right there.
Right. No, yes. Grass is a rare thing in Albuquerque. And did you see all the Breaking Bad sightseeing tours there?
Yes. Oh, yes. A couple people on our journey went. I went actually to the Breaking Bad store because I was a big fan of the show. And I had to partake in that.
Yeah. The last month I got really sick. Really sick.
You were telling me that.
Not with COVID or anything, but I lost my voice and I lost my hearing.
Oh, man.
And I still can't really hear out of my left ear. So I could hear with headphones on. And my voice obviously is back. All that. And the way I knew I was going down this path of absolute, what's happening to me is I decided I would start watching Breaking Bad. And I turned on Breaking Bad and I couldn't hear the show. And I have this new big screen TV and I had to turn the volume up to 100.
Wow. Ooh. Wow.
Zero, 100. And I still had to put on closed caption. And so Annie came upstairs and she says, Stephen, what's wrong? Turn down the TV. The neighbors are going to be. So I couldn't hear it all. So I'm going back to the doctor at the end of this week to see if we can recover some of the hearing in my ear.
Yeah, that's very also scary. Not a show you want at high volume, because yeah, the neighbors will think there's a meth deal going on next door.
Meth thing going on. I know. It is a scary, one of the scariest shows I've ever seen in my life. Mm. It's really terrifying.
Well, do you approach, when you do a drama, and you've done a number of them through the years, you approach them the same as an actor, whether you're doing a comedy or a drama. The best comedy comes when you're playing it straight and let the situations establish the humor.
100%. You should teach acting and be out here and talk. It's the same. You have to, one person once told, there are three kinds of comedy in Hollywood, but I would say the biggest type of comedy is what we would call farce. And I call farce a comedy of intentions. And that is where things that should be important are not important, and things that are not important are made incredibly important. And in fact, people can't see this because this is radio, but this is a theory that was espoused by Sigmund Freud. And here is the book.
And I was going to ask you, you must read my mind. I was going to ask you, what do you have on your bookshelf behind you that's interesting today? And there it is. I'm actually going to take a picture, get a screenshot of this.
Jokes and their relationship to the unconscious. And Sigmund Freud says the secret of comedy is you make the meaningful meaningless and the meaningless meaningful. And that's basically what they look at. Seinfeld. That you have Kramer making ridiculous things meaningful, you have Jerry making very important things meaningless, and it's comedy. But what you have to do is you have to invest in the reality of whatever your situation is. You have to believe in it, whether it's drama or not. And the comedy will come from the fact that you're making things that should not be important. But you have to make them important from your heart and soul and mind. And that's what makes it funny.
Do you still learn about your craft after all these years?
Yeah, all the time. And it's different to doing stage as doing film and doing television, because you have different rules. When you do television, especially if you do something like the Goldbergs, you don't have a lot of time to prepare each scene. And so you realize all you have to do is kind of do an improv with, of course, the great actors you have on the Goldbergs. You stay in character and you keep the scene going with full of meaning, full of everything, knowing that the director will say, okay, that's great, let's keep that, let's do it again and add this. And they'll keep building the scene that way. When you have stage, you have a long rehearsal period. On Broadway, you could rehearse up to 10 weeks before you do a show. When you do like Lopez versus Lopez, you get the script 2 days before you have to start working, and 7 days before you shoot it in front of a live audience. So it's terrifying. But each type of film is the best, because you have all of this time to work, and you could also go over things if you make mistakes. So film is the best for the actor in terms of nerves. That's the best. But what you learn is how important the truth is, and nothing in terms of, the less you could adorn the truth, the more powerful it is and the funnier it is. And also the more out there you could be in a comedy if you feel you're telling the truth. So that's the one thing you really get over the years, is trust in the truth.
I was working with some of my high school actors last night, and I was talking to them about, you know, the challenge when you do something that's got a little more heft to it, is the difference between displaying an emotion and actually feeling and experiencing that emotion. What's a tip you would give young actors? How do you get to that place where you can feel the emotion and not just show what it is?
The advice I would give to young actors, old actors, or any actor, all of acting is not about emotions. It's about clarity of thought. If you know what your character, what is important to your character, and what you're thinking, and what your goal is, and what you're trying to do, you're gonna be emotional 100% of the time. But it's clarity of thought and keep digging in terms of what is important to you. And the more you hang on to that, it will open the doors and you'll be appropriately emotional at the right and wrong time. Never go for the emotion. And I feel sorry for women in this more than anything. I've done a few Law and Orders, and you see those scripts and they say, you know, the woman is talking to the police officer, the victim or whatever, in tears. That she's in tears. And tears mean nothing. But if tears are not dramatic in and of themselves, what is more important is people try not to cry, is what people do in life.
Right.
They try to take control of themselves. So if you are in the moment and if you are believing what you're doing, whether you feel yourself, here's a story. I don't think I told you this story. I was doing Mornings at 7 on Broadway with Julie Haggerty. She was playing my girlfriend on that show. And the show was an enormous success. We had run it for most of the year. Now we were going to move it to Los Angeles for 3 months. But we were closing the Broadway run in 3 weeks. And there's a scene. Julie plays my girlfriend in this. And in this relationship, I've never told her I love her. And as Homer, I'm trying to say, I should have said something. I should have. And in the scene, I never say I love you. But I looked at Julie, and suddenly I was 100% in the moment of thinking like I've just had the most glorious year of my life on this stage with you. And I'm starting to talk, and I realize I can't talk because I'm about to cry looking at her. And Julie looks at me and knows this is going, and she doesn't say a word. She just stays there looking at me. And I keep trying to talk, and I can't. And I'm just saying, and then I start hearing people in the audience begin to cry. And and we were on stage for about 12 years, but I guess it was probably maybe 30 seconds of silence between Julie and I. And I got back on track, was able to finish the scene and get off stage. And people came backstage that night. Different people came, Carol King came, people were coming backstage going, what was that? What was that moment on stage? And, you know, the people in the audience were moved too, but only because they believed Julie and I were moved. And so emotion has nothing to do with it. It has to do with clarity of thought, knowing what you're thinking and doing. Unfortunately, that time, my thought wasn't about the play, but it didn't matter. It still fit.
Is those moments, those lightning in a bottle moments, one of the things that really appeals to you? Because that is not likely to happen in a film or a TV production, because it's the the repetitiveness that leads to that moment. Is that one of the things that really appeals you to stage work?
Well, I'd love that in stage work. Now you have something going against you too in stage work, is that you have a lot of rehearsal. So, you know, you may have that one great rehearsal where suddenly you're on fire, and then you spend the next couple weeks trying to chase the tail of the comet and you never get anywhere. But when you work with, what a great question. When you work with great directors, like I've worked with Ridley Scott, Alan Parker, when you work with great directors, they try to put explosives in the process. They don't tell you all the stuff that's going to happen, and they launch surprises at you while you're shooting. I remember I was doing Mississippi Burning, and Alan Parker, and I was head of the Ku Klux Klan. I was doing the big racist speech where I was on stage, and we had like 2,000 extras in the audience. And at the time, I didn't realize half of them were actually in the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh, God.
That they had used their Klan cards as ID to be extras in this shoot. And so Alan Parker came up to me on stage, and he says, so we're not going to go into the racist part of the speech. We're just going to do the beginning part of the speech. I'll call cut, and then we'll go back to the beginning, and then we'll send all these people home, And we'll do the last part of the speech, which is really racist, but we don't want any trouble. And I go, yes, sir. So it's about, we started about 2 a.m. because usually when you shoot at night, you end up shooting all night. It's 2 a.m. We have 2,000 extras. We do the first part of my speech about 20 times. And then one time, Alan doesn't say cut. And I'm, you know, time 21, he doesn't say cut. And so as an actor, you have to keep going. And I start going into the racist part of the speech. And suddenly, the audience starts screaming. Just screaming. They are so excited. Yes, yes, yes. They start stomping. They start clapping. One guy yells, you should be running for president. And all of these things start happening that I have to play off of on take 21. Wow. And Alan runs up on stage and goes, well, that was a surprise, wasn't it? Why don't we keep shooting this? And so let's not send them home. And so this whole surprise made that scene come alive. And Ridley Scott does stuff like all the time, surprising you. Okay, now we're going to do, and then you're not used to what's going on, and you're like, boom, and you're freaked out. And in Thelma and Louise, you know, I had a freak out. Have I told you the Thelma and Louise story? Do you have time for that?
You have not told us, and we certainly have time.
So Ridley Scott is saying, I was head of the FBI on that one. See, I go from Ku Klux Klan to FBI. And Ridley Scott says, all right, Stephen, so what are you going to do when you come into the room? And I said, well, I thought I would do the lines in the script. He goes, yes, yes, but other than the lines in the script, what are you going to do? And I go, I don't know. And I'm thinking of Law and Order, one of my favorite shows. I'll take over the room. I'll do something to take over the room. And Ridley looks at me kind of, oh, well, all right, let's try. And so we rehearsed a scene, and I did one where I came in the room and I said, okay, Jenkins, get over the phone. I want you to set up a wiretap on line one. So-and-so, I want you to set up outside surveillance on line two. I want you to do this. And I go outside. I'm thinking, like, God, that's so terrible what I did. I mean, that was such a, you know, Ridley said, well, we'll try to shoot one. And I'm going, like, I'm standing outside the front door thinking, I'm so embarrassed because, you know, you don't walk into a radio station, say, okay, Carrie, you know, turn on the volume of the microphone, and here, give me a headphone. You know, professionals know what they're doing. And I think you've run meetings before, Stephen. What do you do? And inside the room, I hear the assistant director says, everyone ready? Camera going? And he says, and I'm thinking to myself, snacks. That's what I do when I run a meeting. I see what people want for snacks. And Ridley Scott goes, action. And so I come in the room, and now I come in with all the FBI agents, and I said, okay, guys, I'm going to make a deli run. Now I'm going to have my usual corned beef and rye, and I'm probably going to have the cappuccino. Anybody else want anything? And all the agents look at me just like, and one guy goes, blueberry muffin? And I go, well, you want it toasted or not? Butter? No, you got to tell me, man. I don't know these things. Tell me. So I start writing down, okay, who wants coffee? Just raise your hand if you want coffees or cappuccinos. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. Anybody want anything like coleslaw? Okay. The coleslaw. Okay, fine. Okay, I'm gonna call this in. I'm going to go pick it up. You guys do your thing. And I left. And Ridley Scott goes, cut, print. Yes. This one. You know, so it was this huge, terrible, horrible, but amazing surprise where I only did the one thing I knew that I usually do, which is take care of snacks when I'm running a meeting. That's what in film you're able to do, is sometimes grab bits and pieces of real life and put it in there.
I love that. Hey, Stephen, it's great to catch up with you. By the way, I noticed too, not only do we match, but you're sporting an L.L. Bean shirt there. Nicely done, making that main connection.
I thought if I got the L.L. Bean shirt, you know, because I've been out there. I've been to the L.L. Bean store out there in what is it, Freeport?
Freeport.
Yeah, I've been out there. I thought it would make me look like a rugged individual. You know, a rugged, self-sufficient individual. But I put this shirt on, and it looks like I'm on Star Trek.
Oh, no.
Am I on Star Trek, but I'm one of the red guys on Star Trek that's going to get killed.
You're not going to last.
That's more of a next generation red shirt though. Right. Those guys were safe.
Yeah.
I will say you will survive because you're a rugged individualist. That's the story there. Yeah. Bruce saying hi as well. Stephen, yes. Thank you so much. It's great to talk with you as always. Hope you get that ear thing straightened out.
We're on tap with the doctor on that in a day, and we'll see how that works.
All right, and good luck with all these projects. We look forward to catching up with you down the road and hearing how all of it played out.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you, Stephen. Our best to Ann.
Bye-bye, Rich. Bye-bye, Carrie.
Stephen Tobolowsky with his son, Downtown.